I don't know what to tell you. You surmounted it.
How?
Leighton smiles. Look, it made sense when you explained it to me, but I can't exactly explain it back. You should read your notes. What I can tell you is that Box creates and sustains an environment where everyday objects can exist in a quantum superposition.
Including us?
Including us. Okay. Though everything I know tells me it's impossible, I apparently figured out a way to create a fertile quantum environment at the macro scale, perhaps utilizing the magnetic field to couple objects on the inside to the atomic scale quantum system. But what about the occupant inside the box? Occupants are observers too. We live in a state of decoherence in one reality, because we're constantly observing our environment and collapsing our own wave function. There has to be something else at work. Come on, Leighton says. I want to show you something. He leads me toward a bank of windows on the side of the hangar that faces the door to the box. Swiping his key card at another secure door, he shows me into a room that resembles a comm center or mission control. At the moment, only one of the workstations is occupied by a woman with her feet kicked up on a desk, jamming out to a pair of headphones, oblivious to our entry. That station is manned 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We all take turns waiting for someone to return. Leighton slides in behind a computer terminal, inputs a series of passcodes, and dives through several folders until he finds what he's looking for. He opens a video file. It's HD, shot from a camera facing the door of the box, probably positioned right above these windows in Mission Control. Across the bottom of the screen, I see a timestamp from 14 months ago, the clock keeping time down to a hundredth of a second. A man moves into frame and approaches the box. He wears a backpack over a streamlined spacesuit, the helmet for which he carries under his left arm. At the door, he turns the lever and pushes it open. Before stepping inside, he looks back over his shoulder, straight into the camera. It's me. I wave, step into the box, and shut myself inside. Leighton accelerates the playback speed. I watch the box sit motionless as 50 minutes races by. He slows the video back down when someone new emerges into frame. A woman with long brown hair walks toward the box and opens the door. The camera feed switches to a head-mounted GoPro. It pans the interior of the box, a light shining across the naked walls and floor, glinting off the uneven surface of the metal. And poof, Leighton says, you're gone. Until he fires up another file. 3.5 days ago. I see myself stagger out of the box and crash to the floor, almost like I was pushed out. More time elapses, and then I watch the hazmat team appear and hoist me onto a gurney. I can't get over how entirely surreal it feels to be viewing a playback of the exact moment when the nightmare that is now my life began. My first seconds in this brave, new, fucked up world. One of the sleeping quarters on sub-level 1 has been prepared for me, and it's a welcome upgrade from the cell. Luxurious bed, full bath, a desk with a vase of fresh-cut flowers that have perfumed the entire space. Leighton says, I hope you'll be more comfortable here. I'm just going to say it. Please don't try to kill yourself, because we're all on the lookout for it. There will be people right outside this door to stop you, and then you'll have to live in a straitjacket in that disgusting cell downstairs. If you start feeling desperate, just pick up the phone and tell whoever answers to come find me. Don't suffer in silence. He touches the laptop sitting on the desk. It's loaded with your work product from the last 15 years. Even goes back to your pre-Velocity Laboratories research. There's no password. Feel free to explore. Maybe it'll jog something loose. On his way out the door, he glances back, says, By the way,
This is going to stay locked. He smiles. But only for your safety. I sit in bed with the laptop, attempting to wrap my head around the sheer volume of information contained in the tens of thousands of folders. The organization is by year, and it goes back to before I won the Pavia, to my grad school days when the first intimation of my life's ambition began to present itself. The early folders contain work familiar to me, drafts of a paper that would ultimately become my first published work, abstracts from related articles, everything building toward my stint in that University of Chicago lab, and the construction of the first tiny cube. The clean room data is meticulously sorted. I read the files on the laptop until I start seeing double, and even then I push on, watching my work advance beyond where I know it stopped in my version of my life. It's like forgetting everything about yourself and then reading your own biography. I worked every day. My notes became better, more thorough, more specific. But still, I struggled to find a way to create the superposition of my macroscopic disc, the frustration and despair bleeding into my notes. I can't keep my eyes open any longer. Killing the light on the bedside table, I pull up the blankets. It's pitch black in here. The sole point of light in the room is a green dot high up the wall that faces my bed. It's a camera, filming in night vision. Someone is watching my every move, my every breath. I close my eyes, try to tune it out. But I see the same thing that haunts me every time I shut my eyes. The blood running down her ankle, across her bare foot. The black hole between her eyes. It would be so easy to crack, to fly apart. In the darkness, I touch the piece of thread on my ring finger and remind myself that my other life is real, that it's still out there somewhere. Like standing on a beach as the tide sucks the sand beneath my feet back out to sea, I can feel my native world and the reality that supports it pulling away. I wonder, if I don't fight hard enough against it, will this reality slowly click in and carry me off? I slam awake. Someone is knocking on the door. I hit the light and stumble out of bed, disoriented, no idea how long I've been sleeping. The knocking gets louder. I say, "I'm coming!" I try to open the door, but it's locked from the outside. I hear a deadbolt turn. The door opens. It takes me a moment to realize when and where I've seen this woman in a black wrap dress, standing in the hallway holding two cups of coffee and a notebook under one arm. Then it hits me. Here. She ran, or tried to run, that bizarre debriefing on the night I came to consciousness outside the box.
"Jason, hi. Amanda Lucas."
"Right. Yes.
Sorry, I didn't want to just barge in."
"No, it's fine. Do you have some time to speak with me?" Sure. I let her in and closed the door. I pull out the chair from the desk for her. She holds up a paper cup.
"I brought you coffee if you're interested."
"Please," I say, taking it. "Thank you." I sit on the end of the bed. The coffee warms my hands. She says,
"They had this chocolate hazelnut nonsense, but you like straight up regular, right?"
I take a sip. "Yeah, this is perfect." She sips her coffee, says,
"So, this must be strange for you."
"You could say that."
"Layton said he mentioned that I might come talk with you."
"He did."
"Good. I'm the lab psychiatrist. I've been here almost 9 years. I'm board certified and all that. Ran a private practice before I joined Velocity Laboratories. Do you mind if I ask you some questions?"
"Okay."
"You reported to Layton."
She opens her notebook.
"Quote, there's just this gaping hole where the last 10 years should be. Is that accurate?"
"It is."
She scribbles something with a pencil onto the page. Jason, have you recently experienced or witnessed a life-threatening event that caused intense fear, helplessness, or horror?
I saw Daniela Vargas shot in the head right in front of me.
What are you talking about?
You people murdered this woman I was with, right before I was brought here. Amanda looks legitimately stunned.
Wait, you didn't know about that?
Swallowing, she recovers her composure.
That must have been horrifying, Jason.
She says it like she doesn't believe me. Do you think I'm making it up?
I'm curious if you remember anything from the box itself or your travels during the last 14 months.
Like I said, I have no memory of it.
She makes another note, says, interestingly, and maybe you don't recall this, but during that very short debriefing, you did say your last memory was of being in a bar in Logan Square.
I don't remember saying that. I was pretty out of it at the time.
Of course. So, no memories from the box. All right, these next few are yes or no questions. Any problems sleeping?
No.
Increased irritability or anger?
Not really.
Problems concentrating?
I don't think so.
Do you feel on guard?
Yes.
Okay. Have you noticed that you have an exaggerated startle response?
I'm not sure.
Sometimes, an extreme stress situation can trigger what's called psychogenic amnesia, which is abnormal memory functioning in the absence of structural brain damage. I have a feeling we're going to rule out any structural damage with the MRI today, which means your memories from the last 14 months are still there. They're just buried deep in your mind. It'll be my job to help you recover them.
I sip the coffee. How exactly?
There are a number of treatment options we can explore: psychotherapy, cognitive therapy, creative therapy, even clinical hypnosis. I just want you to know that nothing is more important to me than helping you through this.
Amanda stares into my eyes with a sudden, unnerving intensity, searching them as if the mysteries of our existence have been written on my corneas.
You really don't know me? She asks.
No. Rising from the chair, she takes her things.
Layton will be up soon to take you down for the MRI. I just want to help you, Jason, however I can. If you don't remember me, that's okay. Just know that I'm your friend. Everyone in this place is your friend. We're here because of you. We're all taking it for granted that you know that, so please hear me. We're in awe of you and your mind and this thing you built.
At the door, she stops, looks back at me.
What's the woman's name again? The one you think you saw murdered?
I don't think I saw. I saw. And her name is Daniela Vargas.
I spend the rest of the morning at the desk, eating breakfast and scrolling through files that chronicle scientific achievements of which I have no memory. Despite my present circumstances, it's exhilarating to read my notes, see them progressing toward my breakthrough with the miniature cube. The solution to creating the superposition of my disc? Superconducting qubits integrated with an array of resonators capable of registering simultaneous states as vibrations. Sounds incomprehensibly boring, but it's groundbreaking. It won me the Pavia. It apparently landed me here. 10 years ago, my first day on the job at Velocity Laboratories, I wrote an intriguing mission statement to the entire team, essentially bringing them up to speed on the concepts of quantum mechanics and the multiverse. One section in particular, a discussion about dimensionality, catches my eye. I wrote, "We perceive our environment in three dimensions, but we don't actually live in a 3D world. 3D is static, a snapshot. We have to add a fourth dimension to begin to describe the nature of our existence. The 4D tesseract doesn't add a spatial dimension. It adds a temporal one. It adds time, a stream of 3D cubes, representing space as it moves along time's arrow. This is best illustrated by looking up into the night sky at stars whose brilliance took 50 light years to reach our eyes. Or 500. Or 5 billion. We're not just looking into space. We're looking back through time. Our path through this 4D spacetime is our world line, reality, beginning with our birth and ending with our death. Four coordinates, X, Y, Z, and T, time, locate a point within the tesseract. And we think it stops there, but that's only true if every outcome is inevitable, if free will is an illusion, and our world line is solitary. What if our world line is just one of an infinite number of world lines, some only slightly altered from the life we know, others drastically different? The many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics posits that all possible realities exist, that everything which has a probability of happening is happening. Everything that might have occurred in our past did occur, only in another universe. What if that's true? What if we live in a fifth-dimensional probability space? What if we actually inhabit the multiverse, but our brains have evolved in such a way as to equip us with a firewall that limits what we perceive to a single universe, one world line, the one we choose moment to moment? It makes sense if you think about it. We couldn't possibly contend with simultaneously observing all possible realities at once. So how do we access this 5D probability space? And if we could, where would it take us? Layton finally comes for me in the early evening. We take the stairwell this time, but instead of heading all the way down to the infirmary, we get off on sublevel 2. Slight change of plan, he tells me. No MRI? Not just yet. He shows me into a place I've been before. The conference room, where Amanda Lucas tried to debrief me the night I woke up outside the box. The lights have been dimmed. I ask, what's going on? Have a seat, Jason. Have a seat. I pull out the chair. Layton sits across from me. He says, I hear you've been going through your old files. I nod. Ringing any bells? Not really. That's too bad. I was hoping a trip down memory lane might spark something. He straightens. His chair creaks. It's so quiet I can hear the light bulbs humming above me. From across the table, he watches me. Something feels off. Wrong. Layton says, My father founded Velocity 45 years ago. In my old man's time, things were different. We built jet engines and turbofans, and it was more about keeping the big government and corporate contracts than doing cutting-edge scientific exploration. There's just 23 of us now, but one thing hasn't changed. This company has always been a family, and our life blood is complete and total trust. He turns away from me and gives a nod. The lights kick on. I can see beyond the smoked glass enclosure into the small theater, and it's filled, just like on that first night, with 15 or 20 people. Except no one is standing and applauding. No one is smiling. They're all staring down at me. Grim. Tense. I note the first twinge of panic looming on my horizon. Why are they all here? I ask. I told you. We're a family. We clean up our messes together. I'm not following. You're lying, Jason. You're not who you say you are. You're not one of us. I explained. I know. You don't remember anything about the box. The last 10 years are a black hole. Exactly. Sure you want to stick with that? Layton opens the laptop on the table and types something. He stands it up, types something on the touchscreen. What is this? I ask. What's happening?
We're going to finish what we started the night you returned. I'm going to ask questions, and this time, you're going to answer them.
I rise from the chair, move to the door, try to pull it open. Locked.
Sit!
Layton's voice is as loud as a gunshot. I want to leave.
And I want you to start telling the truth.
I told you the truth.
No, you told Daniela Vargas the truth.
On the other side of the glass, a door opens and a man staggers into the theater, led by one of the guards clutching the back of his neck. The first man's face is crushed up against the glass. Jesus Christ. Ryan's nose looks misshapen, and one eye is completely shut. His bruised and swollen face streaks blood across the glass.
You told Ryan Holder the truth, Layton says.
I rush over to Ryan and say his name. He tries to respond, but I can't hear him through the barrier. I glare down at Layton. He says,
Sit, or I will have someone come in here and strap you to that chair.
The rage from earlier comes flooding back. This man is responsible for Daniela's death. Now this. I wonder how much damage I could inflict before they pulled me off of him. But I sit. I ask, You tracked him down?
No. Ryan came to me, disturbed by the things you told him at Daniela's apartment. It's those particular things I want to hear about right now.
As I watch the guards force Ryan into a chair in the front row, it hits me. Ryan created the missing piece that makes the box function, this compound he mentioned at Daniela's art installation. If our brain is wired to prevent us from perceiving our own quantum state, then perhaps there's a drug that can disable this mechanism, the firewall I wrote about in that mission statement. The Ryan from my world had been studying the prefrontal cortex and its role in generating consciousness. It's not that far of a leap to think this Ryan might have created a drug that changes the way our brain perceives reality. That stops us from decohering our environment and collapsing our wave functions. I crash back into the moment.
Why did you hurt him? I ask.
You told Ryan you're a professor at Lakemont College, that you have a son, and that Daniela Vargas was actually your wife. You told him you were abducted one night while walking home, after which you woke up here. You told him this isn't your world. Do you admit to saying these things?
I wonder again how much damage I could do before someone hauled me away. Break his nose, knock out teeth, kill him.
My voice comes like a growl. You murdered a woman I love because she talked to me. You've beaten my friend. You're holding me here against my will, and you want me to answer your questions? Fuck you.
I stare through the glass.
Fuck all of you.
Layton says, Maybe you're not the Jason I know and love. Maybe you're just a shadow of that man with a fraction of his ambition and intellect. But certainly you can grasp this question.
What if the box works?
That means we're sitting on the greatest scientific breakthrough of all time, with applications we can't even begin to fathom, and you're quibbling that we go to extremes to protect it?
I want to leave.
You want to leave? Huh. Keep in mind everything I just said, and now consider that you're the only person who's successfully flown that thing. You're in possession of critical knowledge that we've spent billions and a decade of our lives trying to acquire. I'm not saying this to scare you, only to appeal to your logical reasoning. Do you think there's anything we won't do to extract that information from you?
He lets the question hang. In the brutal silence, I glance across the theater. I look at Ryan. I look at Amanda. She won't make eye contact. Tears glisten in her eyes, but her jaw is tense and rigid, like she's fighting with everything she has to hold herself together.
I want you to listen very closely, Layton says.
Right here, right now, in this room.
This is as easy as it's ever going to be for you. I want you to try very hard to make the most of this moment. Now, look at me.
I look at him.
Did you build the box?
I say nothing.
Did you build the box?
Still nothing.
Where did you come from?
My thoughts run rampant, playing out all possible scenarios. Tell them everything I know, tell them nothing, tell them something. But if something, what specifically?
Is this your world, Jason?
The dynamics of my situation haven't materially changed. My safety still depends on my usefulness. As long as they want something from me, I have leverage. The moment I tell them everything I know, all my power goes away. I look up from the table and meet Layton's eyes. I say, I'm not going to talk to you right now. He lets out a sigh, cracks his neck, then says to no one in particular, I guess we're done here. The door behind me opens. I turn, but before I can see who's there, I'm lifted out of my chair and slammed against the floor. Someone sits on my back, their knees driving into my spine. They hold my head in place as a needle slides into my neck. I regain consciousness on a hard, thin mattress that feels depressingly familiar. Whatever drug they injected me with kicks out a nasty hangover. Feels like a rift is opened down the center of my skull. A voice is whispering into my ear. I start to sit up, but the slightest movement takes the pounding in my head to a whole new level of agony.
Jason.
I know this voice.
Ryan.
Hey.
What happened?
I ask.
They carried you in here a little while ago.
I force my eyes to open. I'm back in that cell on the steel frame cot, and Ryan is kneeling beside me. Up close, he looks even worse.
Jason, I'm so sorry.
None of this is your fault.
No, what Layton said is true. After I left you and Daniela that night, I called him, told him I'd seen you, told him where.
Ryan closes his one functional eye, his face breaking as he says,
I had no idea they would hurt her.
How'd you end up in the lab?
I guess you weren't giving them the information they wanted, so they came for me in the middle of the night. Were you with her when she died?
Happened right in front of me. A man just broke into her apartment and shot her between the eyes.
Oh, God.
Climbing onto the cot, he sits beside me, both of us leaning back against the concrete wall. He says,
I thought if I told them what you said to me and Daniela, that maybe they'd finally bring me in on the research, reward me somehow. Instead, they just beat me, accused me of not telling them everything.
I'm sorry.
You kept me in the dark. I never even knew what this place was. I did all that work for you and Layton, but you...
I didn't keep you in the dark about anything, Ryan. That wasn't me. He looks over at me, as if trying to process the magnitude of that statement.
So the stuff you said at Daniela's, that was all true?
Leaning in close, I whisper.
Every word. Keep your voice low, they're probably listening. How did you get here?
Ryan whispers.
Into this world.
Right outside this cell, there's a hangar. And in that hangar, a metal box, which another version of me built.
And this box does what exactly?
As far as I can tell, it's a gateway to the multiverse. He looks at me like I'm crazy.
How is that possible?
I just need you to listen. The night after I escaped from this place, I went to a hospital. They ran a tox screen that returned traces of a mysterious psychoactive compound. When I saw you at Daniela's art reception, you asked me if the compound had worked out.
What exactly were you working on for me?
You asked me to build a drug that would temporarily alter the functioning of brain chemistry
in three Brodmann areas of the prefrontal cortex. It took me 4 years. At least you paid me well.
Alter how?
Put them to sleep for a little while. I had no idea what the application was.
You understand the concept behind Schrödinger's cat?
Sure.
And how observation determines reality?
Yes.
This other version of me was trying to put a human being into superposition. Theoretically impossible, considering our consciousness and force of observation would never allow it. But if there was a mechanism in the brain that was responsible for the observer effect, you wanted to turn it off.
Exactly.
So my drug stops us from decohering?
I think so.
But it doesn't stop others from decohering us. It doesn't stop their observer effect from determining our reality.
That's where the box comes in.
Holy shit. So you figured out a way to turn a human being into a living and dead cat? That's terrifying.
The cell door unlocks and opens. We both look up, see Leighton standing in the threshold, flanked by his guards. Two middle-aged men with two tight polo shirts tucked into their jeans and slightly past prime physiques. They strike me as men for whom violence is just work. Leighton says, "Ryan, would you come with us, please?" Ryan hesitates. "Drag him out of there."
"I'm coming."
Ryan rises and limps to the door. The guards each take an arm and haul him away, but Leighton stays behind. He looks at me.
"This is not who I am, Jason. I hate this. I hate that you're forcing me to be this monster.
What's about to happen?
It's not my choice.
It's yours." I lunge off the bed and charge Leighton, but he slams the door in my face. They kill the lights to my cell. All I can see is the glowing green dot from the surveillance camera that watches me over the door. I sit in the corner in the dark, thinking how I've been on a collision course with this moment since I first heard those footsteps rushing up behind me in my neighborhood, in my world, 5 impossible days ago. Since I saw a geisha mask and a gun, and fear and confusion became the only stars in my sky. In this moment, there is no logic, no problem solving, no scientific method. I am simply devastated, broken, terrified, and on the brink of just wanting it all to end. I watched as the love of my life was murdered right in front of me. My old friend is likely being tortured as I sit here, and these people will undoubtedly make me suffer before my end comes. I am so afraid. I miss Charlie. I miss Daniela. I miss my run-down brownstone that I never had the money to properly remodel. I miss our rusty suburban. I miss my office on campus, my students. I miss the life that's mine. And there in the darkness, like the filaments of a light bulb warming to life, the truth finds me. I hear the voice of my abductor, somehow familiar, asking questions about my life, my job, my wife. If I ever called her Danny. He knew who Ryan Holder was. Jesus. He took me to an abandoned power plant, drugged me, asked me questions about my life, took my phone, my clothes. Holy fuck, it's staring me in the face now, my heart shuddering with rage. He did these things so he could step into my shoes, so he could have the life that's mine, the woman I love. My son, my job, my house, because that man was me. This other Jason, the one who built the box, he did this to me. As the green light of the surveillance camera goes dark, I realize that on some level, I've known since I first laid eyes on the box. Just haven't been willing to look it in the eye. And why would I? It's one thing to be lost in a world that's not your own. Another thing entirely to know you've been replaced in yours. that a better version of you has stepped into your life. He's smarter than I am, no question. Is he also a better father to Charlie? A better husband to Daniela? A better lover? He did this to me. No. It's way more fucked up than that. I did this to me. When I hear the locks in the door retract, I instinctively scoot back against the wall. This is it. They've come for me. The door opens slowly, revealing a single person standing in the threshold, profiled against the light beyond. They step inside, close the door after them. I can't see a thing, but I can smell her. Trace of perfume, body wash. Amanda? She whispers, "Keep your voice down." "Where's Ryan?" "He's gone." "What do you mean, gone?" She sounds on the verge of tears, of breaking down. "They killed him. I'm so sorry, Jason. I thought they were just going to scare him, but..." "He's dead?" "They're coming for you any minute now." "Why are you..." "Because I didn't sign up for this shit. What they did to Daniela, to hold her, what they're about to do to you, they crossed lines that shouldn't be crossed. Not for science, not for anything. Can you get me out of this lab?" "No, and it wouldn't do you any good with your face all over the news." "What are you talking about? Why am I on the news?" "The police are looking for you. They think you killed Daniela." "You people framed me?" "I am so sorry." "Look, I can't get you out of this lab, but I can get you into the hangar." "Do you know how the box works?" I ask. I feel her stare, even though I can't see it. "No idea. But it's your one way out." "From everything I've heard, stepping inside that thing is like jumping out of an airplane and not knowing if your chute is going to open." "If the plane's going down anyway, does it really matter?" "What about the camera?" "The one in here? I turned it off."
I hear Amanda move toward the door. A vertical line of light appears and widens. When the cell door is open all the way, I see that she's shouldering a backpack. Stepping out into the corridor, she adjusts her red pencil skirt and looks back at me.
"You coming?"
I use the bed frame to drag myself onto my feet. Must have been hours in the dark, because the light in the corridor is almost too much to bear. My eyes burn against the sudden brilliance. For the moment, we have it all to ourselves. Amanda is already moving away from me toward the vault doors at the far end. She glances back, whispers,
"Let's go!"
I quietly follow, the panels of fluorescent lighting streaming past overhead. Aside from the echoes of our footfalls, the corridor is soundless. By the time I reach the touchscreen, Amanda is holding her keycard under the scanner.
"Won't there be someone in mission control?" I ask. "I thought there was always someone monitoring."
"I'm on duty tonight. I got you covered.
They'll know you helped me. By the time they realize, I'll be out of here."
The computerized female voice says,
"Name, please."
"Amanda Lucas."
"Passcode?"
2237.
"Access denied."
"Oh, shit."
"What's happening?" I ask.
"Someone must have seen us on the corridor cams and frozen my clearance. Layton will know in a matter of seconds."
"Give it another shot." She scans her card again.
"Name, please."
"Amanda Lucas."
"Passcode?"
She speaks slowly this time, over enunciating her words.
2237.
"Access denied."
"God damn it."
A door at the opposite end of the corridor opens. When Layton's men step out, Amanda's face pales with fear, and a sharp, metallic taste coats the roof of my mouth. I ask, "Do the employees create their own passcodes, or are they assigned?"
"We create them."
"Give me your card."
"Why?"
"Because maybe no one thought to freeze my clearance." As she hands it over, Layton emerges from the same door. He shouts my name. I look back down the corridor as Layton and his men start toward us. I scan the card.
"Name, please."
"Jason Dessen."
"Passcode?"
Of course, this guy is me. Month and year of my birthday backwards. 3721.
Voice recognition confirmed. Welcome, Dr. Dessen.
The buzzer rakes my nerves. As the doors begin to inch apart, I watch helplessly as the men rush toward us, red-faced, arms pumping. 4 or 5 seconds away. The moment there's enough space between the vault doors, Amanda squeezes through. I follow her into the hangar, racing across the smooth concrete toward the box. Mission control is empty, the lights beating down from high above, and it's dawning on me that there is no possible scenario where we make it out of this. We're closing in on the box. Amanda yelling, "We just have to get inside!" I glance back as the first man explodes through the wide-open vault doors, a gun or taser in his right hand, a smear of what I assume is Ryan's blood across his face. He clocks me, raises his weapon, but I round the corner of the box before he can fire. Amanda is pushing open the door, and as an alarm blares through the hangar, she disappears inside. I'm right on her heels, launching myself over the threshold into the box. She shoves me out of the way and digs her shoulder back into the door. I hear voices and approaching footsteps. Amanda is struggling, so I throw my weight into the door alongside her. It must weigh a ton. At last, it begins to move, swinging back. Fingers appear across the door frame, but we've got inertia working in our favor. The door thunders home, and a massive bolt fires into its housing. It's quiet and pitch black. The darkness, so instantly pure and unbroken, it creates the sensation of spinning. I stagger toward the nearest wall and put my hands on the metal, just needing to tether myself to something solid as I try to wrap my mind around the idea that I'm actually inside this thing. "Can they get through the door?" I ask. "I'm not sure. It's supposed to stay locked for 10 minutes, kind of like a built-in safeguard."
"Safeguard against what?"
"I don't know. People chasing you? Getting out of dangerous situations? You designed it. Seems to be working."
I hear a rustling in the dark. A battery-powered Coleman lantern glows to life, illuminating the interior of the box with a bluish light. It's strange, frightening, but also undeniably exhilarating to finally be in here, enclosed by these thick, nearly indestructible walls. The first thing I notice in the new light are 4 fingers at the foot of the door, severed at the second knuckle. Amanda is kneeling over an open backpack, her arm thrust into her shoulder, and considering how everything just exploded in her face, she seems remarkably composed, calmly triaging the situation. She pulls out a small leather bag. It's filled with syringes, needles, and tiny ampoules of a clear liquid that I'm guessing contains Ryan's compound. I say, "So you're doing this with me?"
"As opposed to what?
Walking back out there and explaining to Layton how I betrayed him and everything we've been working toward?" "I have no idea how the box works."
"Well, that makes 2 of us, so I guess we can look forward to some fun times ahead."
She checks her watch.
"I set a timer when the door locked. They come through in 8 minutes, 56 seconds. If there were no time pressure, we could just drink one of these ampoules or do an intramuscular injection, but now we have to find a vein. Ever inject yourself?"
"No."
"Pull up your sleeve."
She ties a rubber band above my elbow, grabs my arm, and holds it in the light of the lantern.
"See this vein that's anterior to your elbow? That's your antecubital. That's the one you want to hit."
"Shouldn't you be doing this?"
"You'll be fine."
She hands me a packet containing an alcohol wipe. I rip it open, wipe down a large swath of skin. Next, she gives me a 3-milliliter syringe, 2 needles, and a single ampoule.
"This is a filtered needle," she says, touching one of them. "Use that one to draw up the liquid so you don't catch a glass shard. Then, switch to the other needle to inject yourself. Got it?"
"I think so." I insert the filtered needle into the syringe, pull off the cap, and then snap the neck of the glass vial.
All of it? I ask. She's tying a rubber band around her arm now and cleaning her injection site.
Yep.
I carefully draw the contents of the ampule up into the syringe and swap needles. Amanda says,
make sure you always tap the syringe and push out a tiny bit of liquid through the needle. You don't want to be injecting air bubbles into your vascular system.
She shows me her watch again. 7:39, 7:38, 7:37. I thump the syringe and squeeze a drop of Ryan's chemical compound through the needle. I say, so I just...
Stick it in the vein at a 45-degree angle, with the hole in the end of the needle facing up. I know this is a lot to think about. You're doing great.
There's so much adrenaline raging through my system, I barely even feel the penetration.
Now what? Make sure you're in the vein.
How do I...
Pull back a little on the plunger.
I pull it back.
See blood?
Yeah.
Good job. You hit it. Now untie the tourniquet and slowly inject.
As I depress the plunger, I ask,
so how long until it takes effect? Pretty close to instantaneous if I had to...
I don't even register the end of her sentence. The drug crashes into me. I slump back against the wall and lose time until Amanda is in my face again, saying words that I'm trying and failing to comprehend. Looking down, I watch her pull the needle out of my arm and press an alcohol pad against the tiny puncture wound. I finally realize what she's saying.
Keep pressure on it.
Now I watch Amanda extend her arm under the glow of the lantern, and as she sticks a needle into her vein and loosens the tourniquet, my focus lands on her watch face and the numbers counting down toward zero. Soon Amanda is lying stretched out on the floor, like a junkie who just shot up, and the time is still running out, but that doesn't matter anymore. I can't believe what I'm seeing.
8. I sit up, clear-headed and alert. Amanda isn't lying on the floor anymore. She's standing several feet away with her back to me. I call out to her, ask if she's okay, but she doesn't answer. I struggle onto my feet. Amanda is holding the lantern, and as I move toward her, I see that the light isn't striking the wall of the box, which should be straight ahead of us. I walk past her. She follows with the lantern. The light reveals another door, identical to the one we just came through from the hangar. I continue walking. Another 12 feet brings us to another door, and then another, and another. The lantern only exudes the brilliance of a single 60-watt bulb, and beyond 70 or 80 feet, the light dwindles off into haunting shreds of illumination, glinting off the cold surface of the metal walls on one side, the perfectly spaced doors on the other. Beyond our sphere of light, absolute darkness. I stop, awestruck and speechless. I think of the thousands of articles and books I've read in my lifetime, tests taken, classes taught, theories memorized, equations scribbled on blackboards. I think of the months I spent in that clean room trying to build something that was a pale imitation of this place. For students of physics and cosmology, the closest one can ever get to the tangible implications of research are ancient galaxies seen through telescopes, data readouts following particle collisions we know occurred but can never see. There's always a boundary, a barrier between the equations and the reality they represent. But no more. Not for me, at least. I can't stop thinking, I am here. I am actually in this place. It exists. At least for a moment, fear has left me. I'm filled with wonder. I say, the most beautiful thing we can experience is the mysterious. Amanda looks at me. Einstein's words, not mine.
Is this place even real? She asks.
What do you mean by real?
Are we standing in a physical location?
I think it's a manifestation of the mind as it attempts to visually explain something our brains haven't evolved to comprehend.
Which is?
Superposition.
So we're experiencing a quantum state right now?
I glance back down the corridor, then into the darkness ahead. Even in the low light, there's a recursive quality to the space, like two mirrors facing each other.
Yeah, it looks like a corridor, but I think it's actually the box repeating itself across all possible realities that share the same point in space and time.
Like a cross-section?
Exactly. In some presentations of quantum mechanics, the thing that contains all the information for the system, before it collapses due to an observation, is called a wave function. I'm thinking this corridor is our mind's way of visualizing the content of the wave function, of all possible outcomes, for our superposed quantum state.
So where does this corridor lead? She asks.
If we just kept walking, where would we end up?
As I say the words, the wonder recedes and the horror creeps in. There is no end. We keep walking to see what happens, if anything will change, if we will change. But it's just door after door after door after door. When we've been going a while, I say, I've been counting them since we started down the corridor, and this is the 440th door. Each box repetition is 12 feet, which means we've already gone a full mile. Amanda stops and lets the backpack slide off her shoulders. She sits against the wall, and I take a seat beside her with the lantern between us. I say, what if Layton decides to take the drug and come charging in here after us?
He'd never do that.
Why?
Because he's terrified of the box.
We all are. Except for you, no one who went inside ever came out again. That's why Layton was willing to do anything to make you tell him how to fly it.
What happened to your test pilots?
The first one to enter the box was this guy named Matthew Snell. We had no idea what we were dealing with, so Snell was given clear and simple instructions. Enter the box, close the door, sit, inject himself with the drug. No matter what happened, no matter what he saw, he was to sit in the same place, wait for the drug to wear off, and walk right back out into the hangar. Even if he had seen all this, he wouldn't have left his box. He wouldn't have moved.
So what happened?
An hour passed. He was overdue. We wanted to open the door, but we were afraid of interfering with whatever he was experiencing on the inside. 24 hours later, we finally opened it.
And the box was empty.
Yep.
Amanda looks exhausted in the blue light.
Stepping into the box and taking the drug is like walking through a one-way door. There's no coming back. And no one's going to risk following us. We're on our own here.
So what do you want to do?
Like any good scientist, experiment.
Try a door, see what happens.
And just to be clear, you have no idea what's behind any of these doors?
None.
I give Amanda a hand up. As I hoist the backpack onto my shoulders, I note the first mild twinge of thirst and wonder if she brought along any water. We head down the corridor, and the truth is, I'm hesitant to make a choice. If there's an endless possibility of doors, then from a statistical perspective, the choice itself means everything and nothing. Every choice is right. Every choice is wrong. I finally stop and say, "This one?" She shrugs.
"Sure."
Grasping the cold metal handle, I ask, "We have the ampules, right? Because that would be..."
"I checked the pack when we stopped a minute ago."
I crank the lever down, hear the latch bolt slide, and pull back. The door swings inward, clearing the frame. She whispers,
"What do you see out there?"
"Nothing yet. It's too dark. Here, let me have that." As I take the lantern from her, I notice that we're standing in a single box again. "Look," I say. "The corridor collapsed."
"That surprises you?"
"Actually, it makes perfect sense. The environment outside the door is interacting with the interior of the box. It destabilized the quantum state. I turn back to the open door and hold the lantern out in front of me. All I can see is the ground directly ahead. Cracked pavement. Oil stains. When I step down, glass crunches under my feet. I help Amanda out, and as we venture the first few steps, the light diffuses, hits a concrete column. A van, a convertible, a sedan. It's a parking garage. We move up a slight incline with cars on either side of us, following the remnants of a white paint stripe that divides the left and right lanes. The box is a ways behind us now and out of sight, tucked away in the pitch black. We pass a sign with an arrow pointing left beside the words, "Exit to Street." Turning a corner, we begin to climb the next ramp. All along the right side, chunks have fallen out of the ceiling and crushed the windshields, hoods, and roofs of the vehicles. The farther we go, the worse it gets, until we're scrambling over concrete boulders and weaving around knife-like projections of rusted rebar. Halfway up the next level, we're stopped in our tracks by an impassable wall of debris. "Maybe we should just go back," I say.
"Look!"
She grabs the lantern, and I follow her over to a stairwell entry. The door is cracked open, and Amanda forces it back the rest of the way. Total darkness. We ascend to the door at the top of the stairs. It takes both of us to drag it open. Wind blows through the lobby straight ahead. There's some semblance of ambient light coming through the empty steel frames of what used to be immense two-story windows. At first, I think it's snow on the floor, but it isn't cold. I kneel, grasp a handful. It's dry and a foot deep over the marble flooring. It slides through my fingers. We trudge past a long reception desk with the name of a hotel still attached in artful block letters across the facade. At the entrance, we pass between a pair of giant planters holding trees withered down to gnarled branches and brittle leaf shards twittering in the breeze. Amanda turns off the lantern. We step through the glassless revolving doors. Even though it isn't nearly cold enough, it looks like a raging snowstorm outside. I walk out into the street and stare up between the dark buildings at a sky tinged with the faintest suggestion of red. It glows the way a city does when the clouds are low and all the lights from the buildings are reflecting off the moisture in the sky. But there are no lights. Not a single one as far as I can see. Though they fall like snow, in torrent-like curtains, the particles that strike my face carry no sting. "It's ash," Amanda says. A blizzard of ash. Out here in the street, it's knee-deep, and the air smells like a cold fireplace the morning after, before the ashes have been carried off. A dead, burnt stench. The ash is falling hard enough to obscure the upper stories of the skyscrapers, and there's no sound but the wind blowing between the buildings and through the buildings, and the whoosh of the ash as it piles into gray drifts against long abandoned cars and buses. I can't believe what I'm seeing. That I'm actually standing in a world that isn't mine. We walk up the middle of the street, our backs to the wind. I can't shake the feeling that the blackness of the skyscrapers is all wrong. They're skeletons. Nothing but ominous profiles in the pouring ash. Closer to a range of improbable mountains than anything man-made. Some are leaning, and some have toppled. And in the hardest gusts high above us, I can hear the groan of steel framework torquing past its tensile strength. I note a sudden tightening in the space behind my eyes. It comes and goes in less than a second, like something turning off. Amanda asks, "Did you just feel that too? That pressure behind your eyes?"
"Exactly."
"I did. I bet it's the drug wearing off." After several blocks, the buildings end. We arrive at a guardrail that runs along the top of a seawall. The lake yawns out for miles under the radioactive sky, and it doesn't even resemble Lake Michigan anymore, but instead a vast gray desert, the ash accumulating on the surface of the water and undulating like a waterbed as black foam waves crash against the seawall. The walk back is into the wind, ash streaming into our eyes and mouths, our tracks already covered. When we're a block from the hotel, a sound like sustained thunder begins in the near distance. The ground trembles beneath our feet. Another building falls to its knees. The box is waiting where we left it, in a remote corner on the parking garage's lowest level. We're both covered in ash, and we take a moment at the door to brush it off our clothes, out of our hair. Back inside, the lock shoots home after us. We're in a simple, finite box again. Four walls, a door, a lantern, a backpack, and two bewildered human beings. Amanda sits, hugging her knees into her chest.
What do you think happened up there? She asks.
Supervolcano, asteroid strike, nuclear war, no telling.
Are we in the future?
No, the box would only connect us to alternate realities at the same point in space and time. But I suppose some worlds might seem like the future, if they've made technological advancements that ours never figured out.
What if they're all destroyed like this one?
I say, we should take the drug again. I don't think we're exactly safe under this crumbling skyscraper. Amanda pulls off her flats and shakes the ash out of them. I say, what you did for me back at the lab. You saved my life. She looks at me, her bottom lip threatening to quiver.
I used to dream about those first pilots who went into the box. Nightmares. I can't believe this is happening.
I unzip the backpack and start pulling out the contents to catalog them. I find the leather bag containing the ampules and injection kits. Three notebooks sealed in plastic, box of pens, a knife in a nylon sheath, first aid kit, space blanket, rain poncho, toiletry kit, two rolls of cash, Geiger counter, compass, two 1-liter water bottles, both full, six MREs. You packed all this? I ask.
No, I just grabbed it from the stockroom. It's standard issue, what everyone takes into the box. We should be wearing spacesuits, but I didn't have time to grab any.
No kidding. A world like that, radiation levels could be off the charts, or the atmospheric makeup drastically altered. If the pressure is off, too low, for instance, our blood and all the liquids in our bodies will boil. The water bottles are calling out to me. I haven't had anything to drink in hours, since lunch. My thirst is blaring. I open the leather bag. It looks custom-made for the ampules, each glass vial held in its own miniature sleeve. I begin to count them.
50, Amanda says. Well, 48 now. I would have grabbed two backpacks, but...
You aren't planning to come with me.
How fucked are we? She asks. Be honest.
I don't know, but this is our spaceship. We'd better learn to fly it. As I begin to cram everything back into the pack, Amanda reaches for the injection kits. This time, we break the necks of the ampules and drink the drug, the liquid sliding across my tongue with a sweet, borderline unpleasant sting. 46 ampules remaining. I start the timer on Amanda's watch and ask, how many times can we take this stuff and not fry our brains?
We did some testing a while back.
Pulled some homeless guy off the street? She almost smiles.
Nobody died.
We learned that repeated use definitely strains neurological functioning and builds up a tolerance. The good news is, the half-life is really short, so as long as we're not slamming one ampule right after another, we should be all right. She slides her feet back into her flats, looks at me.
Are you impressed with yourself?
What do you mean?
You built this thing.
Yeah, but I still don't know how.
I understand the theory, but creating a stable quantum state for human beings is
an impossible breakthrough?
Of course. The hair on the back of my neck stands up as the improbability of it all makes sense. I say, it's a 1 in a billion chance, but we're dealing with the multiverse, with infinity. Maybe there are 1 million worlds like yours, where I never figured it out, but all it takes is one where I did. At the 30-minute mark, I note the first sensation of the drug taking effect. The flickering of a shining bright euphoria. A beautiful disengagement. Though not quite as intense as in the Velocity Laboratories box. I look at Amanda. I say, I think I feel it. She says,
me too.
And we're back in the corridor. I ask, is your watch still running? Amanda tugs back the sleeve of her sweater and illuminates the watch face into tritium green. 3115, 3116, 3117. I say, so a little over 31 minutes since we took the drug. Do you know how long it's supposed to alter our brain chemistry?
I've heard about 1 hour.
Let's clock it to be sure. I move back toward the door to the parking garage and pull it open. Now I'm staring into a forest. Except there's no trace of green, no trace of life, just scorched trunks as far as I can see. The trees look haunted, their spindly branches like black spiderwebs against a charcoal sky. I close the door. It automatically locks. Vertigo hits me as I watch the box push out away from me again, smearing off into infinity. I unlock the door, drag it back open. The corridor collapses again. The dead forest is still there. I say, okay, so now we know that the connections between the doors and these worlds only hold during a given session on the drug. That's why none of your pilots ever made it back to the lab.
So when the drug kicks in, the corridor resets?
I think so.
Then how do we ever find our way home?
Amanda begins to walk, faster and faster, until she's jogging, then running, into a darkness that never changes, never ends. The backstage of the multiverse. The exertion is making me sweat and ratcheting my thirst to an unbearable level, but I say nothing, thinking maybe she needs this. Needs to burn through some energy, needs to see that no matter how far she goes, this corridor will never end. I suppose we're both just trying to come to terms with how horrifying infinity really is. Eventually, she burns out, slows down. There's nothing but the sound of our footfalls echoing into the darkness ahead of us. I'm lightheaded with hunger and thirst, and I can't stop thinking about those 2 liters of water in our backpack, wanting them, but knowing we should save them. Now we move methodically down the corridor. I hold the lantern so I can inspect every wall of every box. I don't know what I'm looking for exactly. A break in the uniformity, perhaps. Anything that might let us exert some measure of control over where we end up. All the while, my thoughts race in the dark. What will happen when the water's gone? When the food is gone? When the batteries that power this lantern, our only source of light, fail? How will I ever find my way home? I wonder how many hours have passed since we first entered the box back at the Velocity Laboratories hangar. I've lost all sense of time. I'm faltering. Exhaustion bears down so hard on me that sleep seems sexier than water. I glance over at Amanda, her features cold but beautiful in the blue light. She looks terrified.
Hungry yet? She asks.
Getting there.
I'm really thirsty, but we should save the water, right?
I think that's the smart thing to do. She says,
I feel so disoriented, and it's getting worse by the moment. I grew up in North Dakota, and we used to get these wild blizzards, whiteouts,
You'd be driving out on the plains, and the snow would start blowing so hard you'd lose all sense of direction. Blowing so hard it'd make you dizzy just looking at it through the windshield. You'd have to pull over on the side of the road, wait it out. And sitting in the cold car, it was like the world was gone. That's how I feel right now.
I'm scared too, but I'm working this problem.
How?
Well, first, we have to find out exactly how much corridor time this drug will give us, down to the minute.
How far do you want to wind out the clock?
If you're saying we have about an hour, then our deadline is 90 minutes on your watch. That accounts for 30 minutes for the drug to kick in, plus the 60 minutes we're under its influence.
I weigh less than you. What if it affects me for longer?
It doesn't matter. The moment it stops working on one of us, that person will decohere the quantum state and collapse the corridor. Just to be safe, let's start opening doors at the 85-minute mark.
And hope for what, exactly?
A world that doesn't eat us alive. She stops and looks at me.
I know you didn't actually build this box, but you must have some idea of how all this works.
Look, this is light years beyond anything I could have.
So is that a no, I don't have any idea?
What are you asking me, Amanda?
Are we lost?
We're gathering information. We're working a problem.
But the problem is that we're lost, right?
We're exploring.
Jesus Christ!
What?
I don't want to spend the rest of my life wandering down this never-ending tunnel.
I won't let that happen.
How?
I don't know yet.
But you're working on it?
Yes, I'm working on it.
And we're not lost.
We are so fucking lost. Literally adrift in the nothing space between universes. We're not lost.
Good, she smiles. Then I'll postpone freaking out.
We move along in silence for a while. The metal walls are smooth and featureless. Nothing to distinguish one from the next, and the next, and the next. Amanda asks,
what worlds do you think we actually have access to?
I've been trying to puzzle that out. Let's assume the multiverse began with a single event, the Big Bang. That's the starting point, the base of the trunk of the most immense, elaborate tree you could fathom. As time unfolded and matter began to organize into stars and planets in all possible permutations, this tree sprouted branches. And those branches sprouted branches, and on until somewhere, 14 billion years down the line, my birth triggered a new branch. And from that moment, every choice I made or didn't make, and the actions of others that affected me, those all gave rise to more branches. To an infinite number of Jason Dessens living in parallel worlds. Some very similar to the one I call home. Some mind-bogglingly different. Everything that can happen will happen. Everything. I mean, somewhere along this corridor, there's a version of you and me that never made it into the box when you tried to help me escape. And now we're being tortured or already dead.
Thanks for the morale boost.
Could be worse. I don't think we have access to the entire breadth of the multiverse. I mean, if there's a world where the sun burned out just as prokaryotes, the first life forms, were appearing on Earth, I don't think any of these doors open into that world.
So we can only walk into worlds that,
if I had to guess, worlds that are adjacent to ours somehow, worlds that split off at some point in the recent past, which are next door to ours, that we exist in or existed in at some point. How far back they branched, I don't know. But my suspicion is there's some form of conditional selection at work. This is just my working hypothesis.
But we're still talking about an infinite number of worlds, right?
Well, yeah. I lift her wrist and press the light feature on her watch. The tiny square of luminous green shows 8450, 8451. I say, the drug should wear off in the next 5 minutes. I guess it's time. I move toward the next door, hand Amanda the lantern,
and grip the handle. Turning the lever, I pull the door open 1 inch. I see a concrete floor. 2 inches. A familiar glass window straight ahead. 3. Amanda says,
"It's the hangar."
"What do you want to do?" She pushes past me and steps out of the box. I follow, the lights shining down on us. Mission control is empty. The hangar quiet. We stop at the corner of the box and peer around the edge toward the vault doors. I say, "This isn't safe." My words carry through the expanse of the hangar like whispers in a cathedral.
"And the box is?"
With a thunderous clang, the vault doors disengage and begin to part. Panicked voices bleeding through the opening. I say, "Let's go, right now." A woman is fighting to squeeze through the space between the doors. Amanda says,
"Oh my God."
The vault doors are only 50 feet away, and I know we should go back into the box, but I can't stop watching. The woman pushes through the doors into the hangar, and then reaches back and gives a hand to the man behind her. The woman is Amanda. The man's face is so swollen and battered, I wouldn't have known right away that he was me, except he's wearing clothes identical to mine. As they begin running toward us, I start to involuntarily retreat to the door of the box. But they only make it 10 feet before Layton's men rush through the doors behind them. A gunshot stops Jason and Amanda in their tracks. My Amanda starts toward them, but I pull her back.
"We have to help them," she whispers.
"We can't." Peeking around the corner of the box, we watch our doppelgangers turn slowly to face Layton's men. We should leave. I know this. Part of me is screaming to go, but I can't tear myself away. My first thought is that we've gone back in time, but of course that's impossible. There's no time travel in the box. This is simply a world where Amanda and I escaped several hours later. Or failed to. Layton's men have their guns drawn, and they're moving deliberately into the hangar toward Jason and Amanda. As Layton steps in after them, I hear this other version of myself say, "It's not her fault. I threatened her. I made her do this." Layton looks at Amanda. He asks, "Is this true? He made you? Because I've known you for more than a decade, and I've never seen anyone make you do anything." Amanda looks scared, but also defiant. Her voice trembles as she says, "I won't stand by and let you keep hurting people. I'm done." "Oh well, in that case." Layton places his hand on the thick shoulder of the man to his right.